Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello and welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Well, today our program's about English justice. We will feature two examples of that coming up, and we'll go to the Black Museum to see where all those murder gadgets are stored. Here's an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard and the Kindly Doctor.
How do you do? This is Clive Brook. Once ever so often, we take for our subject a case which is not really one of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Today's subject, for instance, which we call The Case of the Kindly Doctor. To begin with, it took place some 90 years ago, in 1859. By the way, Percy, how old is Scotland Yard?
It's a good deal older than that, Clive. In fact, you can trace its history right back to the Bow Street Runners. One of these days, we might tell the story how Scotland Yard began.
That's a good idea, Percy. But Scotland Yard didn't come into the case of Dr. Thomas Smethurst. In fact, from the point of view of the police, the case of the kindly doctor was all too simple. However, when the trial began, or rather the trials, the fur really started to fly.
You're right, Clive. The trials of Dr. Smethurst are among the classics of English legal history.
When you hear his story, I think you'll agree that Dr. Smethurst was the kind of doctor whose bedside manner was certainly quite unique. Such a nice, kind doctor. The Central Criminal Court, the Old Bailey, London, Thursday the 7th of July, 1859. Dr. Thomas Smethurst is charged with the willful murder of Isabella Banks. Mr. Sergeant Ballantyne makes the opening speech for the Crown.
The charge I am about to prefer is one of a most serious character. The allegation is that the accused at the bar took away the life of a fellow creature by poison. The accused is a man of information and learning, and he availed himself of the knowledge he possesses and made use of a slow and irritant poison, which he administered himself. Probably you will be of opinion, when you have heard the evidence, that every means was taken by him from the beginning to shroud the whole affair in the deepest mystery.
When our story begins, the romantic Dr. Smethurst is living with his wife, a woman considerably older than himself, at a very respectable lodging house, number 4, Rifle Terrace, Bayswater. It was while he was living there that Miss Isabella Banks first met the doctor. Miss Banks was a lady of respectable family and possessed property to the extent of £1,800. She also had a life interest in £5,000, which on her death went to the other members of the family. This is rather an important point, as you'll realize later. A friendship soon sprang up between Dr. Smethurst and Miss Banks. Friendship is perhaps rather a mild word for it, because some weeks later, their landlady found it was necessary to have a word with them both.
Now, Dr. Smethurst, I've been waiting for a chance to speak to you for some time, and I think it's just as well that Miss Banks should be present.
Well, really, Thomas, if you'll excuse me.
No, dear, I think we should hear what she has to say.
I haven't got much to say, but it's to the point. I simply will not allow such goings-on. There's your dear wife upstairs, Dr. Smethurst, and you downstairs up to I don't know what.
And what do you propose to do about it?
Just this. Miss Banks has got to go. I'll give her till the end of the week, but after that I shall be obliged if she'll find fresh lodgings. I'm not going to ask you to leave, Dr. Smethurst. You and Mrs. Smethurst have been here some time. But these are my final words to you, Miss Banks. You've got to go.
And so she went. But a fortnight later, Dr. Smethurst made his departure too. And if you and I had visited a church in the neighborhood of Battersea on the 9th of December that year, you might have been present at a touching little ceremony.
Repeat after me. I take thee, Isabella, to my wedded wife, to have and to hold.
I take thee, Isabella, to my wedded wife, to have and to hold.
From this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer.
From this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health, to love and to cherish.
In sickness and in health, to love and to cherish.
Till death us do part.
till death do us part. Till death do us part. Well, as matters turned out, Dr. Smethurst had only some 6 months in which to concentrate his loving and cherishing, because by May the 2nd, Isabella Banks was dead. But we're going a little too fast. The so-called marriage took place in December, and in April, Louisa Banks, sister of dear Isabella, had a letter from Dr. Smethurst. It was marked...
private and confidential. Dear Miss Banks, your dear sister wishes me to request the favor of your calling upon her as early as convenient, as she is very, very ill and desires to see you. She also wishes me to say that you will greatly oblige by coming alone. Rail from Waterloo Station about every half hour, and Richmond buses from the White Horse Cellar, Piccadilly, about as often. Yours sincerely, T. Smethurst, 10 Alma Villas, Richmond Hill.
When Sister Louisa arrived, she found Isabella in bed, in a very feeble state.
Isabella, my dear, what's the matter?
Oh, don't say anything about it. It'll be all right when I get well, won't it, dear?
Yes, it'll be all right soon.
But what is being done about it?
She's having the very best medical attention.
Yes, Dr. Julius from Richmond comes to see me every day, and now there's another doctor coming as well, Dr. Bird. But I'm afraid I'm still sick, sometimes several times each day. But when I get well, all will be right, won't it, dear?
Yes, my dear. It's just a matter of time.
And time was running short. For on the 30th of April, a Saturday, Dr. Smethurst visited a solicitor of Richmond, Mr. Senior, taking with him a draft in his own handwriting of a document of some importance.
Mr. Senior?
That's my name.
I've come to see you, Mr. Senior, to find out whether it would be possible for you to come up the hill to the lodgings at which I'm residing in order to make a will for a lady.
Why, certainly. I could, if necessary, come at once.
No, not today. Today would not be convenient. It would have to be tomorrow. I'm afraid the lady will be too ill to see you this afternoon.
But today is Saturday. I presume you mean you would like me to come on Monday.
No, I mean tomorrow.
I must say, Mr...
Dr. Smethurst.
I must say, Dr. Smethurst, I don't like doing business on Sunday. And for that matter, the law doesn't like wills being executed on a Sunday. But I suppose if it's a question of necessity, I shall have to do it.
I have with me a draft of the will. It was drawn up by a barrister friend of mine in London. As a matter of fact, the lady wished to write it herself. But I thought it would be better to be done by a professional man.
Quite, quite. Let me have a look at it, will you?
This is Mr. Senior, my dear. The gentleman who's come to make your will.
Yes, my dear, of course. I have the paper here.
Let me give it to you, Mr. Senior, Isabella, dear.
Yes.
Thank you. This is the document we drew up on Saturday.
It is.
It will be necessary to have another witness.
I'll ring for the daughter of our landlady. Meantime, perhaps you'll read the will. Would you like to hear it, dear?
It's not really necessary. I've read it.
Nevertheless, I think you should hear it again.
This is the last will and testament of me, Isabel Banks, now residing at number 10 Almar Villas, Richmond, in the county of Surrey, Spinster. I give and bequeath to my beloved friend, Miss Jenkins of Walthamstow, Essex, my brooch set with brilliants and pearls and containing the hair of my late father. And as to my real and personal property, estate and effects, whatsoever and wheresoever and of what nature or kind soever the same may be, I give, devise, and bequeath the same unto my sincere and beloved friend Thomas Smethurst, Doctor of Medicine, now also of number 10 Almar Villas, Richmond, aforesaid, for his own use absolutely forever. I hereby appoint the said Thomas Smethurst sole executor of this my will.
By this time, Dr. Julius had started to become a trifle suspicious. Miss Banks showed no signs of improvement. She was constantly sick, and the doctor suspected that some irritant poison was being given to her. He mentioned this to his partner, Dr. Bird, and as Miss Banks still did not improve, decided to call in Dr. Todd, a well-known consultant attached to King's College Hospital. He agreed with the diagnosis of poisoning, but no trace of poison could be found. A second examination was made, and arsenic was discovered. Dr. Smethurst was arrested and charged with...
feloniously administering poison to one Isabella Banks.
Your worship, I protest.
I've been arrested in my own house and brought before you on this ridiculous charge.
Be silent.
But this lady is in the gravest condition. I've been forced to leave her at a critical moment. I must ask to be allowed to return to her at once this evening.
And strangely enough, the magistrate granted Dr. Smethurst's request. He was allowed bail and hastened back to the bedside of Isabella. He was not, however, allowed to interfere in any way with her treatment. On the following morning, she died. It was in these circumstances that Dr. Smethurst faced his trial at the Old Bailey on the 7th of July, 1859. From the very start, it was dramatic. On the second day, one of the jurymen fell ill, and the first trial had to be abandoned. In August, Dr. Smethurst came up for trial again. One after another, the doctors gave their evidence.
I am physician to King's College Hospital. Dr. Julius told me the nature of the case before I saw the deceased, but he did not tell me his suspicion that irritants were being administered to her. When I saw the deceased, I noticed a peculiar expression of countenance, an expression of terror, as though she was under the influence of someone, and that was not in accordance with the appearance of a patient suffering from an ordinary disease.
During my practice, I've seen many cases of acute dysentery of an epidemic character. In my opinion, none of the symptoms exhibited by the deceased was a proof that she died of acute dysentery. I'm of the opinion that her death was the result of some irritant poison having been administered to her.
Witnesses were called to tell the whole sordid story of the doctor's relationship with Miss Banks. The solicitor gave evidence concerning the rather unfortunate circumstances in which her will was made. Everything seemed to tell against Dr. Smethurst. Louisa, her sister, for instance, told of her first visit to Richmond.
I went upstairs and found she was very much altered, but she knew me and she put out her hand and tried to speak, but was unable to do so. I only remained in the room a few minutes. Dr. Smethurst was there all the time. I'd taken some soup with me for my sister, but the accused said it was too strong for her and he mixed some warm water with a portion of it. Dr. Smethurst then said he'd take it downstairs to cool and he left the room for about a minute. When he returned, he gave the soup to my sister and she was very sick. I only saw her once after this. As Dr. Smethurst told me, she could not bear me in the room.
A critical moment of the doctor's trial occurred when Dr. Taylor, the analyst, was giving evidence concerning the first discovery of arsenic.
I next examined the medicines that had been supplied by Dr. Julius and found that they contained the ingredients of which they were represented to be composed. I examined another bottle, number 21, which appeared to contain a clear watery liquid of a saline taste, and I tested a portion of the contents by Reinsch's test. And upon first trying the copper, it was entirely consumed. I made a further test, which led me to suppose that there was arsenic present in the solution.
Which led you to suppose?
Yes.
And this was the evidence you gave before the magistrates when Dr. Smethurst was first charged?
That is correct.
But since then, you have made a further statement.
Yes. It turned out that I was mistaken, and that it did not contain either arsenic or antimony, but that the arsenical appearances originally produced came from the copper galls.
That little mistake over bottle number 21 was the first hint that perhaps things were not quite as black as they looked for Dr. Smethurst. If ever a man was confronted by damning evidence, it was the nice, kind doctor. But as yet, little had been said in his defense. By the third day of his trial, all London was consumed with interest to learn the outcome. For, by the third day, evidence of a strange and unexpected kind was to be brought forward. Dr. Smethurst, it appeared, might still have the ace up his sleeve. On the third day of the trial of Dr. Thomas Smethurst, counsel for the defense, Mr. Sergeant Parry, rose to make his speech.
After having undergone the agony of a double trial, and having endured for a long period the accumulation of prejudice that has been cast upon him, the unfortunate gentleman at the bar has at last the opportunity of laying before a jury of his countrymen the defense he has to offer upon this most serious charge. What is the charge against the accused? It is that he inveigled the unhappy lady into his power, and that he basely and cruelly murdered her for the sake of her property. I believe that the will made by the deceased was the entire foundation for this charge, and that no charge would have been made against the accused if this will had not been executed. Supposing, however, that the will was to be taken as evidence of a motive, what was that motive? It was that he had perpetrated this crime to obtain possession of about 1,700 or 1,800 pounds. But he would equally have come into possession of it if the deceased had lived, for it was clear she was deeply attached to him, and that she had handed over to him the dividend that she received in April. While she lived also, she was entitled to a life interest in 5,000 pounds, and the accused would have had the benefit of that also. And therefore he had a much stronger motive for her to live than he had to destroy her.
Having disputed the motive, the defense now moved on to even more controversial ground, for just as the prosecution had called one medical witness after another, the defense retaliated.
I am a doctor of medicine, a licentiate of the College of Physicians, and professor of anatomy at the Grosvenor Place School of Medicine. I have heard the evidence as to the symptoms of the deceased, and in my opinion, they are not reconcilable with a case of slow arsenical poisoning. There was an absence of several symptoms I should expect to find in such a case.
I'm a doctor of medicine and a lecturer on practical and experimental chemistry. I've heard the evidence of the symptoms exhibited by the deceased and the appearances presented upon the post-mortem examination. And according to my opinion, all these symptoms are consistent with the deceased having died a natural death. And, in my opinion, she died of dysentery.
There was a further complication when the medical witnesses revealed that Miss Banks was expecting a child. One way and another, the doctors managed to contradict each other with alarming frequency. All the circumstances were against Dr. Smethurst, but the medical evidence, on which the case really rested, was not conclusive. Dr. Smethurst could have poisoned Isabella. In fact, it very much looked as though he had. But, and it was a big but, it seemed equally possible that he hadn't. The judge, in his summing up, went very fully into all the evidence given in the case, occupying some 9 hours in his address to the jury. He pointed out to the jury the basis on which they must consider their verdict.
Gentlemen, are you agreed upon your verdict?
We are.
How say you? Is the prisoner guilty or not guilty?
It is my painful duty to record him guilty.
I swear to God that I'm perfectly innocent.
Dr. Smethurst was then called up for judgment. Before being sentenced, he spoke from the dock for over half an hour. His speech contained a number of inconsistencies to which the judge drew attention before saying,
I think you must be perfectly aware that if the whole of it were true, it could not interfere with the painful and awful duty I have to discharge. And it remains for me only to pass the sentence of the law, which is that you be taken to the place from whence you came, and from thence to a place of execution, and that there you be hanged by the neck until you be dead, and that your body be afterwards buried in the prison in which you were confined previous to your execution. And may the Lord have mercy on your soul. The execution of the judgment of the court is committed to the sheriff of the county of Surrey, where the offence was committed.
I declare Dr. Julius to be my murderer. I am innocent!
But this was not the end of the story, for the sentence of Dr. Smethurst brought forth a fresh wave of interest and indignation. The Times was full of letters from doctors, lawyers, and people from every walk of life, including even a letter from Dr. Smethurst's legal wife, who protested his innocence. There was no doubt about it. Whether you believe the doctor was guilty or innocent, there was quite a lot of evidence to support your story. Too much evidence to make the verdict as clear-cut as a verdict should be in an English court of law. All the letters and all the petitions poured into the office of the Home Secretary, and surrounded by so many conflicting opinions, the Home Secretary decided to rest his case on one opinion. He sent all the evidence and all the documents to a personal friend, and the foremost surgeon of his day, Sir Benjamin Collins Brodie, who, after considering the case, replied,
My dear sir, having carefully gone over the papers which were forwarded and relating to the trial of Thomas Smethurst, I send the conclusions at which, using my best judgment, I have been able to arrive. Smethurst's indifferent moral character rendered him a just object of suspicion. 2. there is really no trustworthy evidence of Miss Banks having taken arsenic. And indeed, many of the symptoms which it is well known arsenic produces were absent in Miss Banks' case. 3. Since his conviction, nothing has been found to show that Smethurst had purchased poison at any chemist's, or that he had taken any other means of procuring it. 4. It is rather in Smethurst's favor that although the period of her death was uncertain, the will under which he inherited Miss Banks' property was not made until within a very short time from the fatal termination of her illness. Taking into consideration all that I have now stated, I own that the impression in my own mind is that there is not absolute and complete evidence of Smethurst's guilt. I am, dear sir, yours faithfully, B.C. Brodie.
For a great many years, Monday had been the day upon which executions took place in the county fair. But as this meant the erection of the scaffold on the top of the jail on Sunday, adverse criticism led to the alteration of the day to Tuesday. And, according to the custom of the time, Tuesday fortnight was fixed for the carrying out of Smethurst's sentence. Time went by, and only 48 hours before the appointed day, the Home Secretary received the reply from Sir Benjamin Brodie. The Home Secretary made his decision.
After a very careful and anxious consideration of all the facts, I have come to the conclusion there is sufficient doubt of the prisoner's guilt to render it my duty to advise the grant to him of a free pardon, which will be restricted to the particular offence of which he stands convicted. It is my intention to institute a prosecution against him for bigamy. The necessity which I have felt for advising Her Majesty to grant a free pardon in this case has not, as it appears to me, arisen from any defects in the constitution or proceedings of our criminal tribunals. It has arisen from the imperfection of medical science and from the fallibility of judgment in an obscure malady, even of a skillful and experienced medical practitioner.
And thus the Home Secretary managed to get himself out of a dilemma by annoying the medical experts on both sides, who were at last unanimous on one point. They deeply resented the Home Secretary's remarks. The law didn't waste any time, and in point of fact, Dr. Smethurst was brought up on a charge of bigamy before his pardon had been confirmed. In the course of his defense, Dr. Smethurst's counsel alluded to this pardon.
I am sure the jury will agree with me that the prisoner ought to be now treated upon the footing that he is perfectly innocent of the crime of murder. And I cannot help expressing my opinion that the Home Secretary has done himself great honor by the investigation he has made, and which has resulted in his advising Her Majesty to grant the prisoner a free pardon.
If I may interrupt, I must say that the learned counsel is hardly justified in making the observation he has done with regard to the innocence of the prisoner of the crime of murder. A pardon is no more a certificate of innocence than a verdict of not guilty. Silence.
Throughout these proceedings, Dr. Smethurst didn't utter a single word. After all, there was very little for him to say.
You have found the prisoner guilty on this charge, and I have consulted with the officers of the court upon the subject, and they have concurred with me that the sentence I am about to pronounce is a proper one, and that is that you be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 1 year.
And that, you might think, would be the last appearance in the court of law of our friend, the doctor. Far from it. Having had so much trouble over the little matter of Isabella Banks's will, Dr. Smethurst was not likely to forget it. And having completed his year's vacation at Her Majesty's expense, he returned to the battle determined to get his dues. He produced the famous will and endeavored to prove it. Sister Louisa claimed that it had been procured by undue influence and control of the plaintiff, and that her sister had not been of sound mind. Once again, the old story was told in court.
After Dr. Smethurst was taken into custody for the first time, I went immediately to my sister. She thanked me for my kindness and wished me to be with her. I was with her until just before she died. Except on that occasion, I never had any private communication with her.
I am not able to assign any natural cause for her death. I had ordered medicines principally of a soothing character. None of the medicines I ordered would account for the appearances that were exhibited. Certainly not.
In my opinion, the symptoms of the deceased were not reconcilable with a case of slow arsenical poisoning. There was an absence of several symptoms I should expect to find in such a case.
I believe that her death was occasioned by the administration of some irritant poison, such as arsenic, antimony, or corrosive sublimate.
The old, old story. But you see, they couldn't really prove it one way or the other. And Dr. Smethurst again had the benefit of the doubt. The court ordered probate of the will to be granted to the plaintiff. In other words, he got the money too. Well, Percy, What do you think about the case?
I know one thing, Clive. It couldn't happen today.
I should hope not. But why exactly do you say that?
Well, you must remember this case occurred in 1859. Since then, the scientific tests for arsenic have been so greatly advanced that any doubt on the presence of the poison will be removed. Today it can be detected in the hair or the fingernails. Of course, there was the interim period.
You mean, Percy, we might have got away with it? But how?
That's one of the secrets of Scotland Yard.
After hearing Percy Hoskins, I think you'll agree that it may be a very good thing, too, that that nice, kind Dr. Smethurst lived when he did, nearly 90 years ago. Well, that's all for now, but Percy Hoskins and I will be back again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Meanwhile, this is Clive Brooks saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.
If your name is Robert Benson, you're about to be judged. Act of Violence, 1957.
The jury are coming back.
Members of the jury, are you agreed upon your verdict?
We are.
Do you find the prisoner, Robert Benson, guilty or not guilty of murder?
Guilty.
You find the prisoner guilty, and that is the verdict of you all?
That is our unanimous verdict.
Prisoner at the bar, you stand convicted of murder. Have you anything to say why sentence of death should not be passed upon you according to law?
I'm innocent. I'm absolutely innocent.
Robert James Benson, the sentence of the court upon you is that you be taken from this place to a lawful prison and thence to a place of execution, and that there you be hanged by the neck until you are dead.
The BBC presents A Case for Dr. Morell, another adventure by Ernest Dudley, with Cecil Parker as the famous Dr. Morell and Sheila Sim as his secretary, Miss Frame. Act of Violence.
Road, Dr. Morell. It's difficult to realize we're only 30 miles from London.
Which, from my point of view, lends it an added attraction.
I always think that Essex is a bit cut off. Why are you slowing the car?
Well, I feel positive that I'm following the directions given me by Professor Stenberg, but I'm not certain that he gave me the right ones to follow. What was it, Miss Frail, that produced that profound sigh?
Oh, it must be marvellous always to feel so sure you're right and the other person must be wrong.
Professor Stenberg is a trifle absent-minded, while I have reason to remember this locality from a case with which I was concerned.
What was that, Doctor?
A rather sordid, lurid affair, which wouldn't interest you in the slightest, but I recall that there was a less devious road than this to Lower Ashton.
Oh, there's a garage ahead. How about asking there? I'll ask this man. Are we right for Lower Ashton, please?
Lower Ashton? Well, you're going the long way round.
What's the matter?
I
somehow thought there was a shorter route.
That's right, sir, yes. Take the second turning on the right, and that'll cut off 3 miles.
Oh, you were right, Dr. Morell. Thank you. I'm sorry to have bothered you.
Anywhere in particular you want in Lower Ashton?
Professor Stenberg's house. Perhaps you know it.
You'd have gone miles past there. This other road, you can't miss it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, miss. Good afternoon, doctor.
That was funny, wasn't it?
What, my dear Miss Frail?
Well, that young man. The sudden look on his face, as if
As if what?
As if he'd seen a ghost.
I wasn't noticing anything particular.
Of course you were. I believe it was something to do with you.
What aroused that dark suspicion in your mind?
The way he acted. I've just thought of something.
What, again?
Don't you remember? He called you doctor. Now, how could he know that?
I fancy I can answer that without much difficulty.
How?
Because you addressed me as Dr. Morell in his hearing.
Oh, did I? Oh, well, that explains it.
This is the turning which should reduce our journey by 3 miles.
There are more houses now, Doctor. We shall soon be there.
I recollect this neighborhood.
Oh, yes. That case you mentioned. Look, there's a signpost.
Lower Ashton half a mile.
Thank you, Miss Trail.
Oh, and do you see that poster? A concert at the village hall. What fun. Oh, look, Doctor, Robert Benson's performing.
So I observed. The young man at the garage.
That's what I was thinking. But...
But what, Miss Trail?
I'm surprised at you, though.
Indeed.
Just because that's the name of the garage doesn't mean that it's his name.
Do go on.
Well, he could be an employee there.
I'm gratified that the balmy air hasn't dulled your sharp wits.
I expect you're a little overtired driving.
It so happens that I was already aware of his name.
Oh. Oh, so I was right then. He did recognize you.
I'm only surprised that he hasn't changed it.
What do you mean, Dr. Morell? Where was it you'd seen him?
In the dock at the Old Bailey.
Lovely house it is, Doctor, with all that garden.
I'm glad you're impressed.
Oh, that's Professor Stenberg coming down the drive. Hello, Professor Stenberg.
How nice to see you again, Miss Frank.
Lovely to see you, Professor.
Oh, it's very good of you to come, Dr. Morell.
Delighted, I'm sure.
Come in, Miss Frail. The garage is at the back, Doctor. You'll find Staples, my man there. He'll take your cases up to your rooms.
I'll take the car around.
Oh, it's such a delightful old house.
I hope you'll enjoy your stay.
I know I will.
Come into this room. It overlooks the garden.
Oh, what wonderful big windows.
I enjoy sitting here in the evening to listen to the birds. Sometimes at night you can hear the old owl hooting in the wood.
Oh, it must be a really wonderful spot.
It's most kind of Dr. Morell to come down to discuss this one knotty problem with me.
I think it's lovely of you to ask me as well.
But you will want to go to your room, hmm? Your suitcase will be out there by now. Staples will have seen to that.
Thank you.
It is the room directly overhead. There's a balcony where you can sit if it's sunny.
Oh, thank you so much, Professor. I'll go on up.
Dinner will be at 7. Ah, there's Dr. Morell in the garden. I'll tell him about his room. This way, Miss Frail. Up the stairs and turn left.
Thank you.
I'll go and fetch the doctor. Dr. Morell, how about a glass of sherry?
Oh, it's so quiet and peaceful after London. Extraordinary meeting that young man like that. I wish Dr. Morell hadn't shut up like an oyster about it. He really can be very irritating sometimes. I'll just go out on the balcony before I go downstairs. Oh, what a lovely evening, isn't it? I feel like the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet. Not that anyone's ever likely to mistake me for Juliet. Oh, what a pity Dr. Morell isn't down in the garden. But there is someone there. It can't be Dr. Morell. He's in his room. Perhaps it's the gardener. Why, he's looking up here. What is it?
I want to speak to you. Can't you nip down for a minute?
You're the man at the garage.
And you were with Dr. Morell. You've got to tell me something.
And I thought it was going to be quiet and peaceful.
Better do what I say for Dr. Morell's sake.
What?
I'm warning you.
Oh dear. All right. Well, wait there and I'll come down. For a moment, I thought you'd gone.
You can't be seen from the house here.
We can be heard, and if you try anything, I'll scream my head off.
You know who I am. You know I'm Robert Benson, don't you?
Well, suppose you are.
And Dr. Morell recognized me, just as I recognized him.
He did know your face, yes.
And what's he doing snooping down here after me?
I don't know what on earth you're talking about.
Why can't he let sleeping dogs lie?
Really, Mr. Benson, unless you've got something to tell me,
I've got something to tell him, all right. So you let him know I'm here.
Dr. Morell? Well, I'm afraid he's busy changing for dinner.
Better do as I say, miss, or it'll be the worse for him. Tell him I want to see him now.
Will I?
Do as I say, or else. Come in.
Oh, Dr. Morell, the man from the garage, he's in the garden.
Young Benson?
Yes, he insists on seeing you.
Does he?
He thinks you're down here snooping after him.
An unfortunate chance that we should have encountered each other on the way.
He seems in a bit of a state about you.
Yes, perhaps I should have a word with him.
Hadn't I better come with you? Supposing he's got a gun or a knife.
I don't think you need have any fears for my safety.
Well, if you're sure you'll be all right.
I'll go and speak to him.
my name and got a little further away. Only changing a name isn't so easy. I had the chance of this garage business. Nobody twigged me. But now you have to come down here.
What induces you to imagine that I have any interest in you?
Well, you were at the Old Bailey when I was convicted. When they tried to make out I killed that girl.
When they subsequently realized that there was a flaw in their case, the prosecution, as much as your own lawyers, were responsible for establishing your innocence. It may interest you to know that I added my voice to those who believe someone other than yourself was the murderer.
Then what are you doing here? You're not going to tell me it's a coincidence.
Coincidence has a long arm. My presence at Lower Ashton is concerned entirely with Professor Stenberg and nothing whatever to do with you.
You expect me to believe that?
Who knows? Your curiosity may yet be satisfied.
They'll never get him now.
Destiny possesses plenty of patience. Good night, Benson, and I hope goodbye.
How does your cigar agree with you, Dr. Morell?
Excellently, thank you, Professor.
Oh, they've got a most luxurious aroma.
You have some more coffee, Miss Frey?
No, thank you.
I sometimes think of it as a commentary upon human existence. A cigar's aroma is more exciting than the actual flavor on the palate.
The shadow that proves to be more alluring than the substance.
I think it's the same about the smell of coffee. It's nicer than the taste.
Surely what we are discussing is the gulf between anticipation and realization. Another example is the prisoner's dream of freedom. Almost invariably, when that freedom is achieved, sooner or later, he will look back on his cell as a place of refuge against the troubles of the world, which naturally beset him beyond the prison walls.
An interesting idea, Doctor.
I suppose that's why you get unhappy love affairs.
I fail to see the comparison.
Well, I mean, while a girl is trying to get her man, she's thinking how wonderful it'll be when she's got him. When she has, she wonders if the trouble was worth it.
And vice versa, Miss Freer.
Distance lends enchantment to the view. Oh, that sounds like Major Penfold's car. I forget to mention that he would be looking in tonight for a smoke and a chat. Excuse me. It's all right, Staples. It's Major Penfold. I'll let him in.
Why, dear Major, how nice to see you. Do come in.
Good evening, Professor. I'm a bit later than I meant to be, I'm afraid. Yes, the rehearsals went on much longer than usual.
Ah, yes, you must be very busy.
Up to my eyes, Professor, up to my eyes.
May I introduce Major Penfold, Miss Frail? Miss Frail, Major Penfold.
Good evening.
How do you do?
Dr. Morell. Major Penfold.
Good evening.
This is a great pleasure. Professor Stenberg told me you'd be here for the weekend, and believe me, I haven't dropped in for a spot of his brandy and a cigar, or... That's merely an excuse to meet you, Doctor.
Well, I am very flattered.
And you, of course, Miss Frey.
Oh, thank you.
All the same, Professor, some brandy and a cigar wouldn't come amiss.
Of course, Major, of course. Major Penfold is the hub around which Lower Ashton's social life spins.
Yes, I try to take an interest in local affairs. You know, it's quite true.
Your brandy?
Oh, thank you.
Cigar? Yeah,
thank you, Professor. Yes, it was a pretty dead and alive hole when I came here. I thought I could do with a shot in the arm and all that, you know.
And you certainly have made things hum. Athletic club, bridge parties, flower show, church fetes, amateur theatricals.
That's what I'm up to my neck in now.
You've got a concert very soon, haven't you? We saw a poster on our way down.
Wednesday night as ever was. Star-studded entertainment. Pity you won't be here to see.
Oh, what a shame. I'd love to.
Really, Miss Frail? By the way, Professor, I haven't told you, have I? No, this will interest you, Dr. Morell.
Well, indeed.
It's by this morning's post, a dramatic sketch for the show, sent anonymously with 4 5-pound notes towards the church fund. Serious, if we'll perform it.
What an odd idea.
The author didn't give his name at all.
Not a clue. But it's a rattling good little play, yes. A real thriller. Just your cup of tea, Doctor.
It sounds most intriguing.
I had it typed out, only two characters, and gave it to my 2-star performers to study. Rehearsals tomorrow night, after church. Tell you what, Dr. Morell, you ought to come to the rehearsal. Yes, give us your expert opinion.
No. We're returning to London tomorrow night.
Oh, pity. Might have amused you.
Oh, I'm sure it would be very thrilling.
Odd thing. Don't you think this anonymous business... I suppose it isn't you, Professor Stenberg.
What's that, Major?
Who's written this thriller? Hiding your light under a bushel?
Me? I fear I don't possess quite that sort of talent.
I don't know. You do a lot of scribbling.
Well, I hardly think you would find it had any entertainment value.
No, I'm sure it's very useful in another way.
Thank you, Miss Fay.
Why should he send it anonymously when he's so anxious to have it done? Hence the 20 quid bribe, so to speak.
Well, perhaps perhaps it isn't a man, perhaps it's a woman.
I fancy Major Penfold is right in assuming the author is male.
Well, what makes you say that?
Whatever imponderables may lie in the recesses of the feminine mind, one thing is certain. A woman would never go to the trouble indicated here deliberately to hide herself from the benefit of the ensuing publicity.
Well, not long ago there was a book by an anonymous author who turned out to be a woman. Oh, I forget her name.
You prove my point, Miss Frayle. If she was anonymous, how was she revealed to be a woman?
Pretty smart of you, Dr. Morell. I agree. It seems much more like that it's a man.
But what would be his motive?
Paradoxically, an attempt to fix attention upon himself. He feels impelled, on the one hand, to reveal to the world at large some innermost knowledge he possesses, while on the other, to stand back in the shadows and observe the effect of his action.
Anyway, it's a pity you can't come along and see us rehearsing tomorrow night.
Oh, couldn't we, Doctor?
Why don't you look in just before you leave?
Yes, yes, we could do that.
Oh, well, very well, Miss Frayle, if it would interest you.
Oh, that's very good of you, Dr. Morell. I'm sure that Major Penfold will be delighted.
Indeed, really most kind of you. Yes, it'll give us a big kick to have the great criminologist watch our efforts.
Are you acting in it yourself, Major?
No, I'm kept busy behind the scenes. Yes. See to the props and the rest of it. It's only a short dramatic sketch, but it certainly packs a punch.
Oh, I'll just go and see who that's for.
Is that for me, Staples? No, Professor. Someone wants to speak to Dr. Morell.
Oh, Dr. Morell. Ask him to hold on, will you? It's for you, Dr. Morell.
Oh, thank you.
How does anyone know you're here? I deliberately told no one where you'd be.
If you'll excuse me.
Oh, I hope it doesn't mean the doctor will be called back to London. Oh,
so do I.
Me too. A bit of a letdown if you don't come to see our show after all.
Oh, we shall be awfully disappointed.
Dr. Morell speaking.
It's Benson, Dr. Morell. Robert Benson.
Oh, yes?
Dr. Morell, I've got to see you.
Well, I can't imagine that it can be necessary. I've already reassured you about...
This is something that's happened since I saw you. You've got to help me.
I don't quite see how I could.
You can, believe me, or I wouldn't be phoning you. And when I explain it, you'll see.
But when?
As soon as possible, tonight.
This is preposterous.
Oh, look, Dr. Morell, I'm talking from the garage. But I can meet you in about half an hour's time outside Professor Stenberg's house. We can talk there quietly.
In half an hour?
At 10. Make an excuse to get some fresh air. I'll be waiting at the drive gate.
Oh, this is most inconvenient.
I'll be there. 10 on the dot by the gate. And I beg of you to be there, too.
And this is supposed to be a quiet weekend.
Thanks for the nightcap, Professor. Yes, that brandy really hits the spot.
You'll have one for the road, Major?
Oh, no. Oh, thanks. I'm driving. Ah, here's Dr. Morell.
Was it anything important, Dr. Morell?
You haven't got to rush back to London tonight.
No, I'm glad to say no.
So we'll see you and Miss Frayle at the rehearsal tomorrow night.
Oh, we're looking forward to it.
You'll come along too, of course, Professor.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I'd like to.
Well, I must be on my way. Good night, Miss Frayle.
Good night, Major.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night, Professor.
Good night, Major. Good night.
Is that you, Dr. Morell?
It is.
It's me, Benson. Listen, Doctor. Someone in this town is out to ruin me. I thought I was safe here, but I was wrong. Someone knows who I am, and they intend to blow the gaff.
Haven't we been into this already?
I don't mean you. I'm sorry for the way I talked earlier on. No, this is someone else. Simply because I was accused of a murder I never did. After 2 years, when I built up my garage business and put the past behind me...
What evidence have you for all this?
It was tonight at the rehearsal of the show for church funds. A dramatic sketch they're doing.
You are concerned with the local amateur theatricals?
Yes, always been keen on it. But this is a real blood curdler. And you know what it's about? The murder of a young girl.
You mean the plot resembles your own case?
Word for word. Practically a replica of the scene between me and her that night.
You must bear in mind that dramatic plots are forever being devised by authors... It would not be unusual if one were imagined which would seem to fit the case involving you.
I tell you, this has got it off pat. It's uncanny. The place, the time, the very hour.
Those details came out at the time of the trial. The author might have been present or read the newspaper reports.
I know it's someone who's found out about me and deliberately means to ruin me here so that I'll have to clear out.
With what object?
Oh, I don't know. But listen, Dr. Morell, there's something else I haven't told you about this play. I've been given the part... of the murderer.
Extraordinary business, Dr. Morell.
Yes, I somehow imagined it might intrigue you. Where is Professor Stenberg?
Oh, he went off to his study for a few moments. He works late too, Doctor.
Quite, Miss Frayle.
What an odd coincidence that Major Penfold should have been talking about the dramatic sketch.
Benson is the only young man in the Dramatic Society, which explains why he was given the role.
Then it must have been written by someone locally, who'd not only discovered who he was, but calculated that he would have to reenact his own experiences.
That, my dear Miss Frayle, would appear to be a reasonable deduction.
Oh, what a rotten thing to do. And what for?
Various motives offer themselves, but it still might be that which persuades the author to remain anonymous.
You mean what you were saying about it being someone who really wants to attract attention to himself? I don't understand it.
Man's darkest continent is the human mind, and its explorer encounters vast, arid deserts of inhibition and secret fear.
Yes. Yes, Doctor. Anyway, Mr. Benson's going through with it and playing the part?
That is what I urged him to do. To run away would simply provide his unseen adversary with the satisfaction of knowing that he'd scared him off. To stay and face the consequences might discourage any further attempt upon his peace of mind.
You're absolutely right, Doctor, of course.
I'm gratified to learn that you are in agreement with me.
If he does it, he's very brave.
He might also discover who's behind all this. I promised to call at his garage in the morning. He seems to have some notion the play holds a clue to the author's identity.
Oh, it's you, Professor. I thought I heard someone outside the door.
I hope you enjoyed your breath of fresh air, Doctor.
Thank you. It was quite refreshing.
Forgive me deserting you, but I'm afraid I'm growing increasingly absent-minded. I have to make a note of things when I think of them. Otherwise, I completely forget.
Oh, I'm sure Dr. Morell could offer some explanation for that, Professor.
Ah, the inroads made by advancing age upon the mental faculties, eh, Doctor? Oh, by the way, I'm sorry about Major Penfold. I'm afraid he can be a bit of a bore.
Well, not at all.
I rather liked him.
He's done a tremendous amount for the town, but I don't know that he ought to have inflicted his amateur theatricals on you.
I'm sure we're both quite looking forward to it, aren't we, Dr. Morell?
Quite, Miss Frayle.
I can tell you that your presence at the rehearsal will be something of an event for Lower Ashton Dramatic Society.
Mr. Benson's waiting for us.
Good morning, Dr. Morell.
You've met my secretary, Miss Frayle?
Yes, we have met. How do you do?
Good morning, Mr. Benson.
Come into the office. My assistant will take over for a while.
Come along, Miss Frayle.
There you are. There's the little drama, Dr. Morell.
Thank you.
Only a few pages, as you see, but they're full of dynamite.
Oh, what's it called? Act of Violence. Ooh, that's a gripping title.
It's gripping, and no mistake. In every sense of the word. Just you read the lines before the curtain, Dr. Morell.
Shall I read it with you, Doctor?
Yes, go on, Miss Frayle. Go ahead.
Oh, this is really rather fun, isn't it? Fancy, I've never acted with you before, Doctor.
It isn't much of a part for the girl, as you'll see.
Oh, no love scenes.
Now, come along, Miss Frayle. I'll begin here. You haven't been quite so smart, up to date, my girl.
Why do you say that?
You've told me you live by yourself, that you haven't any relatives, and you won't be missed until you go back to work next week.
But why should I be missed then? You talk as if I'm not going back to work.
Do I? How strange of me. Or am I being psychic?
What's the matter? Why are you staring at me in that funny way?
If you don't want to look at me, look at yourself in the mirror.
But what is this? I don't like it. I'm frightened.
Don't turn away. You'll see it all in the mirror.
What's that you're taking out of your pocket?
You can see it in the mirror.
It's a pair of nylons. Oh, the present you promised to give me.
You're mistaken. It was only one of a pair of nylons.
But what's the use of one stocking?
It's the finest quality. See how soft it is.
Keep away.
Feel the texture.
No.
Round your throat.
Don't.
That's it, Doctor. And that's how the real thing went, almost word for word.
Oh, how very creepy.
You can say that again, Miss Frayle. Well, when I read it over last evening, my blood ran cold.
In actual fact, what happened, as I remember you described it in the witness box, was that you put the stocking round her neck to frighten her.
Well, that's all I did, and then I left her.
And the real murderer came back afterwards?
Yes, miss, a few minutes afterwards, and strangled her with the stocking.
I always maintained that the real murderer was listening outside the door. He hid when you came out and then went in.
She has certainly had plenty of men friends. All sorts. Young, middle-aged, rich and stupid, and the brainy sort.
What are you thinking, Dr. Morell?
Miss Frayle?
There's that look on your face.
Merely a notion that has occurred to me. Then we shall be at this evening's rehearsal, Benson.
Just to give you moral support.
I'm going through with it. Dr. Morell was right.
I know, he always is.
I'll show this anonymous so-and-so that Robert Benson doesn't scare so easily.
There is one step you can take by way of an experiment which might prove fruitful.
Hmm? What's that?
Listen carefully and follow my instructions.
I really can't wait, Doctor, for the rehearsal this evening.
It should provide a certain amount of interest.
All the same, it still baffles me that anyone could go to such lengths.
It is characteristic of the twisted mind to seek to achieve its purpose by twisted means. The author of this play, not inappropriately titled Act of Violence, evidently bears some dark secret in his soul whose weight is proving too much for his conscience. He can expiate his guilt only by making full confession in public.
Oh, it's most fascinating in a horrid kind of a way. Oh, there are the drive gates ahead. Oh, what a lovely old house the professor's got.
I'll turn the car in here.
Oh, and there's Professor Stenberg waiting for us.
So I see.
He's coming with us to the rehearsal tonight, isn't he?
Yes, Professor Stenberg will doubtless be quite interested in what transpires.
Hello, Professor. We're back.
Hello, Miss May. You're quite smart up to date, my girl.
Why do you say that?
You told me you'll live by yourself, but you haven't any relatives, and you won't be missed until you go back to work next week.
I think you acted the part just as well, Dr. Morell.
Quiet.
But why should I be missed then? You talk as if I'm not going back to work.
Do I? How strange of you. Or am I being psychic?
What's the matter? Why are you staring at me in that funny way?
And I was as good as her.
You don't have to look at me.
Something's different, Doctor.
Shh!
There's no mirror.
Quiet!
But what is this? I don't like it. I'm frightened.
Don't turn away.
What's that you're taking out of your pocket?
You can see for yourself.
Oh, it's a pair of nylons. Oh, the present you promised me.
You're mistaken. It's only one of a pair of nylons.
What's the use of one stocking?
It's the finest quality. See how soft it is.
Keep away.
Feel the texture
no.
around your
no,
throat.
No, don't!
Oh! That's the curtain. What did you think of it, Professor?
Very dramatic. Everyone will be hanging on to their seats on Wednesday night.
But the ending is a bit different. Dr. Morell, where are you going?
A word of congratulation to Major Penfold.
He's bound to be at the back of the stage, running the show.
I'll find him.
I'll stay here and keep the professor company.
Yes, do that, Miss Frail.
Thank you, Miss Frail.
Are you looking for someone?
Major Penfold.
Oh, behind the scenery on the other side of the stage.
Thank you. And may I congratulate you on your performance?
Oh, how very sweet of you.
Hello, Major Penfold.
Oh, Dr. Morell.
May I offer my congratulations to you? But you appear a trifle agitated.
Of course, the whole thing was ruined.
Indeed.
The mirror. There was no mirror. He should have strangled her while she was looking at him in the mirror, and it wasn't there.
Was its presence so important?
Don't you understand? That's what really happened. That's why I wrote it. That's why... Oh, my heavens, what have I said?
Nothing that surprises me, Major Penfold.
You mean you knew? You knew all along.
It was evident that the anonymous author was someone living locally. I had already reached the conclusion that he felt an obsessive urge to confess some deadly secret. From my own inside knowledge, it became obvious to me, moreover, that the author knew a little too much about the Robert Benson murder.
My head's spinning. I must get some air.
The position of the mirror, that was something which no one but the murderer could have known.
I must open the door.
It was to be your fate to come here to live, to encounter the very man who might have hanged for your crime.
You can't prove anything. Leave me alone.
Your conscience will never let you rest.
I can't breathe. Let me get from here.
Oh, there you are, Dr. Morell. Well, what did you think of it?
Most satisfactory. You followed my instructions to the letter.
Oh, was that the major who went out?
He was in need of a little air.
Well, where's he going off in his car? What the devil, we've got more rehearsing to do.
You needn't trouble yourself about act of violence. It was a case of one performance only.
He's driving at a lick. What's come over him? He's stepping on it. What were you saying, Doctor?
Doctor, oh, there you are. Hello, Mr. Benson. Where's Major Penfold?
He's just driven off in his car as if the devil was on his tail.
What's that?
It's the Major. He smashed his car.
That flash in the sky. It's caught fire. You can see the flames.
You saw the crazy way he drove that car, Doctor.
Yes.
You think he did it purposely.
Dr. Morell, what's happened?
He did. Major Penfold deliberately drove to his death.
That was another adventure in a BBC series featuring Ernest Dudley's famous character, Dr. Moreau, and, of course, his secretary, Miss Frail. The artists taking part were Dr. Morell, Cecil Parker, Miss Frail, Sheila Sim, Professor Stenberg, Martin Miller, Robert Benson, Trevor Martin, Major Penfold, Rafe Truman, and other parts were played by Will Layton and Louise Gainsborough. This recorded program was produced by Leslie Bridgemont.
Let's take a moment to visit with Bob and Ray and the Insomniac Theater, and then it's back to London for the Black Museum and the Raincoats.
Welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, to the Bob and Ray Insomniac Theater. Today, for the first time on radio, the soundtrack from a 1931 motion picture, Varsity Variety, starring Fatso Cromwell as the hero at State University. We'll be ready to go in just 30 seconds.
Well, wait a minute. Forget the 30 seconds. We couldn't sell this bomb, so let's get right to the movie.
There are no commercials, ladies and gentlemen, so we'll get right to the soundtrack of Varsity Variety.
Hey, Eddie!
Yeah?
What dorm are you in this fall?
C7.
Oh, yeah? I'm over at Muldoon Hall.
Hey, you going to play in a big game Saturday?
I don't know. All depends on what I get in my grades.
Yeah, well, the coach has been pretty strict about that.
Yeah, the new director of athletics. I don't know, he's pretty tough. I don't know how to figure him. Say I have to bone up on my chemistry or I won't play in the big game against Tech.
It's going to be a big game between State and Tech Saturday.
Yeah.
Wish I could play instead of being just a water boy.
Well, you're puny, aren't you?
Yeah, I feel just like Johnny Downs sitting there on the bench all the time.
Well, you puny guys seem to get all the girls at the dance anyway.
It works out that way.
We football heroes show up, you know, with adhesive tape on our face and like that and a couple of teeth out.
Yeah.
The girls don't go for it.
Well, you don't look so attractive that
way. I don't know about that song. You know, I'd like to be a football hero.
Yeah.
But the way it goes.
Well, I'll see you over the malt shop.
Like a bee on a football. Thorn! Whatever your name was.
Coach?
Yeah?
I'm the director of athletics here.
Well, I hope you won't be interfering with the game here.
I just have the chemistry grades on McGlinchey.
Yeah, what about McGlinchey?
Get him out of uniform. I don't care what he is. His chemistry grades are not up to snuff.
You
mean, not up to the standards of State.
You mean McGlinchey can't play today? Why, we'll lose the game.
He not only will play, he'll be on the 5 o'clock train home. Bum.
Well, Coach, I got the water pails here. Gee, I wish you'd let me play today. I got into this uniform just in case.
Stevie, I think I may have to use you.
Well, what do you mean?
McGlinchey flunked his chemistry grade.
McGlinchey? You mean McGlinchey won't be playing today?
I'm afraid he won't be in the... He won't be...
But he's
I know he's a... Of course he is.
You mean I might get...
Shut up. Go on in there and get McGlinchey's suit.
Right, Coach.
Hey, get out of here with McGlinchey's suit!
Ah, you guys shut up now. Coach has given me my big chance.
But please, it's down on the ground there.
Yeah, well, you'll see. All this season, I wanted to play football. Now
what,
I
are you
going to
try 7 foot
in a... All right, you guys, just shut up.
You're going to be on our team? Go on over and play with Tech, will you? We want to win this one.
Yeah, you'll be laughing the other way. Hello, Margie.
Hello.
See you standing here right outside the locker room.
What are you doing in McGlinchey's suit?
Well, McGlinchey can't play. His grades weren't good enough, so the coach is putting me in.
Putting you in place of McGlinchey?
That's right.
Ha! Ha!
Oh, yeah, well, you'll be laughing a different tune after the game.
The suit doesn't even fit you. You'll be smeared.
Okay, let's go.
Get that little kid, go!
And
Who's that out on the field now, taking McGlinchey's place? What was his name? My spotter says that,
He's a little puny guy. I think he's wearing McGlinchey's suit.
Yes, it's Stevie, and he's wearing McGlinchey's suit. There's the ball spun back to him, and he starts off down toward the tech goal. He's running. He's running.
Look at that.
I've never seen anything like this, ladies and gentlemen.
What's
wrong? It's one of the greatest runs I've ever seen in all my years of broadcasting. And he's over for the winning touchdown.
Well, congratulations, Stevie.
Thanks, Coach.
I never realized you were really serious.
Sorry
about
I can't
football.
Stay around, Coach. I got a date with Martin.
My hero!
And so ends today's soundtrack at the Insomniac Theater, Varsity Variety. Next week, another exciting first-run feature, this time dealing with the underworld, entitled It Came From Out of the Sink.
For our final program this week, we'll visit the Black Museum. Now, this is a real place in London, England, and it's a place where the devices of murder are put on display for police and others to look at. This particular crime is associated with a raincoat. And here it is, the Black Museum.
The Black Museum. Here, in a grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, there's a warehouse of homicide. A very strange room where everyday objects, a woman's shoe, a tiny white box, a quilted robe, all are touched by murder. You take this raincoat. It's a familiar object, waterproof cloth, rayon lining, collar, you can turn up against stormy weather. Here in London, it's called a Macintosh. But you wouldn't wear this raincoat.
Oh, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman?
And partially burned, as if someone had tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant, this raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position in that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Museum starring Orson Welles.
Now here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's museum. It's a museum of murder. Here are the objects of homicide, the weapons, the clues, which one time and another betrayed killers. They've been collected over 100 years, and now here they are, shelf upon shelf, in this dim,
echoing room. Here lies death, on these shelves, in these glass cases. Just for instance, in this case, simple mallets. Just the sort of thing a suburbanite might use in his garage or his shop working at wood carving on a quiet weekend. As a matter of fact, a suburbanite did use this mallet on a quiet weekend, but not for wood carving. Ah, the raincoat. Here we are. Stained, charred, too, around the edges. There's nothing you'd like to handle for very long, but there's a story attached to it. A story begins in the kind of place you immediately associate with absolute silence. No, not a graveyard. A chess club. It is silent, isn't it? And into this silence of concentration, there intruded...
London City Chess Club.
Is Mr. Agard there?
Sorry, sir, I haven't seen him yet. This is the steward of the club. May I take a message? We're expecting him.
I see. My name is Champer. This is 46 Edison Mew East. He knows. We've had some contact by way of Agard's insurance business.
Yes, sir. And the message?
I want to see him about a policy. Tell him it's rather urgent. I want him at my house tomorrow evening at 7:30 sharp.
Very well, sir. I'll tell him as soon as he gets in. Mr. Agard, sorry to disturb you, sir.
Just a moment, steward. There. Now, your move. Now, steward, a most important telephone message for you, sir. Came in about half an hour ago before you came in. Otherwise, I would never have disturbed you. From a Mr. Champer, sir.
Champer. Strange name. Oh, yes. Yes, perhaps I do know him. May I have the message, steward?
That was all. That was all until the next evening. A little bit after 7 o'clock, on a streetcar, this quiet little insurance salesman, John Agard, said to the conductor of the streetcar...
I beg your pardon. Does this car take me to Edison Mews East? I've never been out there before, you see. I'm not...
Yes, concerned. You're all right, mister. Take you about 20 minutes from here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll call it out for you, if you like.
Oh, yes. Thank you again. Thank you very much. I beg your pardon. May I trouble you for the right time, please?
It's 7:35.
I am right for Edison Mews East, aren't I?
That one block to the car line.
Oh, thank you. I beg your pardon, Constable.
Yes, sir?
I am looking for a Mr. Champer. In Edison Mews East, I have an appointment. It's insurance. Do you happen to know the gentleman, officer?
Oh, I'm afraid not, sir.
Oh, dear, and my date was for 7:30. Is it much past that now?
7:45, sir. Steeple chimes just struck for 3:15.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry to have troubled you, officer.
He seemed a worried little man, John Agard. Upset over his difficulty in finding Mr. Champer, and he was still worried, apparently, about an hour later, when his next-door neighbors, Harry and Ethel Benson, saw him coming across the scrap of lawn which separated their houses.
Is Agard coming over? Funny.
Why is it funny, Harry? They come over very often.
That's just it. Martha isn't with him. Funny.
Such a devoted couple. Martha had a bad cold today. Perhaps John needs something.
Well, no, isn't enough. There he is. Hello, Agard. Spotted you coming across the lawn.
Yes, good evening. You know, I am sorry to bother you.
No bother at all. Do you need something for Martha's cold?
Oh, you know about that. No, and yes. I suppose the cold made her forget to unbolt the doors when she went to bed.
You mean you can't get into your own house, old man?
That's it. Front and back. I can't seem to open either of them. I don't quite know what to do about it.
Not like Martha to forget a thing like that. She always bolt the door behind you when she's alone.
Oh, at night, yes. There's only the two of us. I do so rarely go out without her, but tonight it was business. If you come across with me, I'd appreciate it.
The three of them crossed the lawn to the Agard house. Three ordinary people. An insurance agent, a bank clerk, a bank clerk's wife. The wife said...
Let me try the front door, just for luck.
John Agard said...
It won't help her. I've tried several times.
The woman tried it.
Well, that
That's a bit strange. I could have sworn.
It happens lots of times. The lock gets stuck. It's really open, and you think it's locked, and it just won't work.
Well, now you're here, won't you stop in for a moment? Well,
what with Martha's cold and all that...
She'll like to see you. Come in, please.
Well, just for a minute.
Martha? Martha, dear? The Bensons are with me. Martha!
Oh, my...
Good Lord. She was dead. Completely, horribly dead. One look. No doctor could help. The woman's head was battered in. She lay before the fireplace, her arms and legs twisted awkwardly like some carelessly dropped wooden figure, and there was blood on the hearth. On the walls, too, on the chair, on the rugs. And tucked around the body, as you tuck a blanket around a child, was a raincoat.
Let me go over this once more, Mr. Agar.
Of course, Inspector, if you think it'll help.
Details very often help. You say you left here just before 7, took a trolley to Edison Mews, that you couldn't find the address or the man who'd called you, even asked a constable on the beat. Then you returned home to what you found.
That is correct, sir.
And your wife was alive when you left home.
Oh, of course. That was about 7:15.
The boy who delivers milk says he saw her in the kitchen through the window about that time. The newsboy says he tossed the evening paper at the front door about 6:30, but saw no one. Can you corroborate any of those points?
Oh, I took the paper with me at 7:15. Martha was alive when I left. Who could have done this, Inspector? Who?
We'll find out. We usually do. May I see the cuffs of your trousers, Mr. Agar?
The cuffs of my... Oh, yes. But whatever for?
Thank you. No? No stains of any kind?
Do you really think for 1 minute that I...
We think nothing. Not yet. The raincoat, Mr. Agard, is it yours?
And are there 2 worn spots at the buttonhole?
There are.
It's mine.
When did you see it last?
It was hanging on its usual hook in the hall.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Agard. That's about all for now.
That's about all for now. But not nearly all. The experts were at work. Somewhere, somehow, the tiny thread which would lead to the heart of the tangle would be found. In a quiet office in Scotland Yard, Inspector Mason discussed the experts' reports with Sergeant Crandall.
It couldn't have been robbery.
Agard reports nothing missing.
Agard reports a lot of things, including a mysterious telephone call that took him on a wild goose chase.
During which he seems to take good care to leave a clear trail of his own movements. She was seen alive between 6:30 and 6:45. Agard was in the tobacco shop at 7:35. The girl who works there remembers him.
He probably took good care she would.
Beyond a doubt he did that. But he couldn't have battered her to death after 6:45, cleaned up, destroyed whatever he was wearing, and still be in that shop at 7:35.
Or made that trolley car a few minutes after 7.
Exactly.
Which leaves us, Inspector?
With a raincoat.
It's odd, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman?
And partially burned, as if someone tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant, this raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
That was all they had. The raincoat. Inspector Mason thought about it.
It was tucked around her, just as if someone who loved her were taking care of her.
There was a thread. It seemed the only thread. Where did it lead? Where could it lead? Where could any of it lead?
John Agard, you're under arrest, and you'll be later charged with the murder of your wife, Martha. It is my duty to caution you that anything you may say...
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position. In that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. We continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, they charged John Agard with the murder of his wife, Martha. The evidence seems slight, pretty flimsy, but still, there were strange lapses, contradictions of character. Quiet little insurance salesman responds to a call from a possible client, and suddenly he's talkative, almost garrulous. He establishes himself at definite places at definite times with total strangers, all of whom can be checked quite easily by the police. The possible client is non-existent. And then, of course, there was the raincoat. From the very beginning, the prosecutor for the Crown made it clear that a great deal of his case rested on that raincoat.
And if the prisoner did commit this murder for apparently no reason, he deserves the full punishment. Much will be made of the quiet life he led with his wife. Much will be made of the fact that no telltale trace of blood was found on him or his clothing. But I say to you, and we hope to prove this to your satisfaction, that this woman could have been beaten to death by someone wearing only the raincoat, which we will place in evidence. Now, who, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, could have approached Martha Agard naked save for that raincoat, except her husband, the prisoner, John Agard? Moreover, as you will see, the police officer...
There was more of the same, much more. Counsel for the Crown was out to make an impression, no doubt about that, but then... So was counsel for the defense.
My client admitted that no trace of blood was found upon my client, although from the condition of the body and though time. John Agard could never have committed this crime, performed the necessary ablutions, and been where he was definitely seen between 6:45, when his poor wife was last seen alive by a third party, and 7:05, the moment when my client spoke to the trolley conductor. But far, far more important is the relationship between my client and his poor wife, a relationship of love, of understanding, of the perfect companionship of declining years. For that reason alone, I submit my client could never have committed the crime with which he stands charged today.
So it began. The legal lines of battle were drawn. 12 honest men sat in the jury box and gave their whole attention to the parade of witnesses, to the arguments, to the cross-examinations. Sergeant Crandall gave evidence on the amount of blood and the places where it was found. Defense counsel cross-examined.
It is apparent, Sergeant, that there was an attempt to burn the raincoat, which is now in evidence. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Such an operation would take some time, would it not?
Well, I assume so. I can't say for certain. I've never experimented with a raincoat.
Very well. You saw the scene of the crime before it was cleaned up, did you not?
I did.
From what you saw, would you say it was possible for the killer to escape splashes of blood?
Well, I doubt it.
He would get blood on his legs, his hands, his face, his hair.
I expect so.
Were any such traces found on my client?
Well, none that I know of.
There's been a suggestion made that the murderer took a bath before leaving the premises. Did you see any traces of a bath? A wet towel, indications in the bathtub?
No, sir. Nothing like that.
One more point, Sergeant.
These are the telling points. But the Crown made its own points as well.
Inspector Mason, what did you know of the defendant when you first questioned him?
I was rather surprised at him. He showed less emotion than I did.
How was this indicated?
We sat in the room where the murder had occurred. Mr. Agard smoked and talked. He held his cat on his knees and stroked it quite calmly. At one point, he casually stepped...
Such points do... A clever prosecutor. Quite clever. He called the steward of the chess club.
Was Mr. Agard in the club when the telephone call came from this mysterious Mr. Champer?
No, sir. I looked particularly. He was not there.
Did you recognize this Champer's voice?
I'd never heard it before. I haven't heard it since.
Might it have been a disguised voice?
It might. It sounded muffled. Very heavy, sort of.
Thank you. Your witness.
Steward, in your observations of Mr. Agard, have you ever seen him behave as a poor loser?
No, sir, never.
Has he ever expressed violent opinions, to your knowledge?
Mr. Agard violent? He's the quietest man I've ever known.
Did he ever mention his wife to you?
Many times, sir.
On what occasions?
Usually about 9 in the evening. He always worried about leaving her alone too late at night, sir. Oh, very considerate of her he is, was, sir.
Thank you, that's all.
There it was, all they had. An elusive case. An impression, really, more than a case. Very difficult to prove, but just as difficult to defend. For instance, the evidence of Harry Benson, who was with John Agard when the body was discovered.
And in all the years you've been neighbors, what would you say impressed you most about my client's relationship with his wife?
His absolute devotion. Never a quarrel, never a raised voice. They liked the same things. They were perfect for each other.
Your witness.
Mr. Benson, after the discovery, who called the police?
Why, Agard did, come to think of it. My wife was very upset. She was sick over what she'd seen, as a matter of fact. Yes, he was the one who thought of the police. He used the telephone quite calmly.
Quite calmly? Thank you, Mr. Benson.
And naturally, the defense brought John Agard's immediate superior to the stand, the manager of the local branch of the insurance company Agard represented. This man's testimony was double-edged. On direct examination, he stated,
"We have always had complete faith in Mr. Agard's integrity and character. He carried a large policy on his own life in favor of his wife. She was not insured. To the best of our knowledge, which is rather complete, Mr. Agard has never been in financial trouble in his life."
But on cross-examination, he explained,
"Yes, I live near Edison Mews East. Mr. Agard has been to my house many times. He knows the way very well. I cannot imagine why he asked for directions. I was at the cinema that evening. My neighbor recognized Mr. Agard when he came to the door of my house. Unfortunately, I was not at home."
When John Agard's turn came to take the witness stand, there was little left for him to say.
"I did not kill her. I had no reason to. I loved her."
Opposing counsel summed up. The judge made his charge to the jury.
"Again and again, you have heard the importance of the time element in this case. Could this man, or any man, have committed this crime, removed all traces of it from his person, dressed and been at a trolley car line 20 minutes from his house, in the time between the moment the milk boy saw the victim alive and the moment the conductor saw the defendant on the trolley car? More, there is no evidence to connect the defendant directly with the crime. The case is entirely circumstantial. No motive has been established. I could only..."
They listened. The 12 honest men in the jury box. They retired and they debated. What went on in that jury room is sealed in silence under the honored tradition of the law. Anyway, 40 minutes elapsed. Then the jury re-entered the courtroom. The clerk asked the usual question. "Are you agreed upon a verdict?"
"We are."
"Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty?"
"Guilty." "Prisoner at the bar,
Have you anything to say why you should not die according to the law?
I am not guilty. I have nothing else to say.
You are looking well, John.
They treat me well. I had a shock yesterday. The governor of the prison came here. He said 8 o'clock in the morning, Monday the 16th.
Don't worry, John. It will be put over.
The appeal?
It's being studied. The court won't rule for another month at least. They are going to stay of execution.
A month. Another month.
A month. An extra week after that. Time went on endlessly, it seemed, to John Agard, waiting in his cell in Walton Prison. And at long last, they gave him his own clothes and took him before three judges of the Court of the Criminal Appeal. Handcuffed, he stood there between the bailiff and his own counsel. The voice of the judge seemed very far away.
There is indeed reasonable doubt in this case. We believe there is imminent difficulty and doubt. The case against the appellant was not proved with the certainty necessary to a verdict of guilty. This appeal will be allowed. The prisoner will go free.
Yes, he went free. But the raincoat, that famous raincoat, can still be found today in its place of very particular honor in that curious room known as the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Here in person is Orson Welles.
So, Inspector Mason was wrong, wasn't he? The raincoat didn't hang anybody after all. John Agard went free, and for the first time in the history of English law, a conviction for murder was set aside for reasonable doubt. Now, what happened to John Agard? He lived out his life. Just 2 years after his release, he died. Some say of loneliness in Liverpool, a broken, weary old man. I've seen his grave in Liverpool, and I've seen the raincoat, that famous, enigmatic raincoat, in its place of particular honor, in that strange room in Scotland Yard, known as the Black Museum. Now, till we meet again in the same place for another story of the same kind, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.